today of biographies of great Rabbanim. Today we will discuss the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the great synagogue, and we'll also talk about mostly about the Tanoim, the authors of the Mishnah. This year has been graciously sponsored by David Baruch Greenstein in memory of Shmuel Yitzchak Kraft, of blessed memory. Please visit us online at EnglishTorahTapes.com, where you can listen and download thousands of Torah Shiurim for free. May the learning of Torah be a merit for myself, yourself, for listening to the Shir. May the learning of Torah also be a merit for the memory of Aaron Fuchs, Shimon, and Hinda Manila of blessed memory. The Mishnah says that Moshe received the Torah at Sinai and handed it down to Yeshua. Yeshua gave it to the elders to the prophets, and the prophets handed it down to the men of the great assembly. This, according to the sages of the Talmud, was how the Torah was preserved through the generations. By the Torah is meant here not only the written Torah, the five books of Moshe, and the other books of the Tanakh, but also the oral law, that is the correct interpretation of the written law. It explains it, so we understand the written law. Thus the men of the great assembly were the spiritual heirs of the prophets and the forerunners of the sages of the Mishnah. The great synagogue or assembly was a council of elders and prophets presided over by Ezra the Sofer. Among its members were Daniel, Mordechai, Nehemiah, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and others, and in function for about 30 years from the years 3370 after creation to 3400, counting its membership to 120 men. Later it was succeeded by the Sanhedrin, numbering 71 sages. Ever since Rubavel and Yeshua led back the first group of the new settlers in Eretz Israel, this supreme council kept a watchful eye on their spiritual life and ruled on all questions pertaining to Jewish life, religious, social, and economic. Under Ezra and Nehemiah, however, it attained its height of influence, which became our spiritual heritage to this day. For a great portion of our present-day religious life, our prayers, customs, and practices dates back to the men of the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. And by the way, while we're discussing Ezra and Nehemiah, the entire Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah is available online at EnglishTorahTapes.com with commentary, as well as Jewish history. Complete Tanakh of Jewish history is also available online at EnglishTorahTapes.com. So if you would like to study Ezra and Nehemiah in greater depth, you'll be able to do so. Under the guidance of Ezra the Sofer, the council introduced many important institutions in Jewish life. Thus, they instituted that the courts be convened on Mondays and Thursdays, the Beis Din. There was a practical reason for this, because in these days, Jewish farmers gathered in Yerushalayim and other big cities to bring their products to the market and make their purchases. Should there arise any problems or disputes, the courts were readily available to deal with them, give guidance, and dispense justice. Among the other things, the men of the Great Assembly regulated the custom of congregational reading of the Torah. Since the days of Moshe, it was the custom to read the Torah on the Shabbos, the Jewish holidays, the Rosh Chodesh, the New Moon, Chol HaMoed, the intermediate days of the Yom Tov, and on Mondays and Thursdays. But the readings of the Torah had not been fixed, except in the Beis Medrash on special occasions. The men of the Great Assembly determined the selected readings for all occasions for Jews throughout the world. The Torah was divided into weekly portions to be read every Shabbos, and in the course of 1 year, the whole Torah would be concluded. The procedure of the reading of the Torah was very much the same as we have it now. An officer of the congregation would call in turn upon several Jewish men to say a blessing over the Torah and read a portion. The number of those called varied from 3 during the weekdays to 7 on the Shabboses. Boys from the age of 13 and older were eligible to be called up. If there was a Kohen, a descendant from the priestly family of Aaron, in the congregation, he was honored with the first portion. A Levi was next to be called, and then other members of the community. In the beginning, each individual called up to the Torah would read his portion. But later on, when the Jews were not always able to read their portion from the Torah, and in order to avoid embarrassment for the less educated, an official reader was appointed, the Baal Kore, to read the portions for everyone, while the honored members only recited the blessings. In later years, a special translator, Meturgaman, was appointed to interpret the portion and translate it into Aramaic, the language mostly used by the Jews at that time, for the benefit of those who did not understand Hebrew, the sacred tongue of the Torah. The men of the Great Assembly recorded the prophecies of the 12 minor prophets. And they're not really minor, they really were great prophets, it's just that they prophesied small amounts. So they put it all together in one sefer called Trei Osar. And also the books of Yechezkel, Daniel, and Esther. They instituted the Feast of Purim. One of the most important and lasting institutions introduced by the men of the Great Assembly was the regular divine service or daily prayers. The custom of praying to Hashem dates back to the days of our ancestors Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, who introduced the morning, afternoon, and evening prayers respectively. Some prayers were recited in the Beis HaMikdash on the occasion of the offerings on the altar. But the custom of praying was not widespread, nor were the prayers designated and arranged in a definite way. During the Babylonian exile, when the Beis HaMikdash lay in ruins and no services or sacrifices were offered, there the people longed for a substitute way to commune with Hashem. It was then that simple houses of prayer were first established where Jews congregated to worship Hashem in their own way. Their custom was brought along by the returned exiles who came to rebuild the holy city and the Beis HaMikdash. And even after the Beis HaMikdash, the second Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt, and the pilgrimages were renewed three times a year, going to Eretz Yisrael three times a year, to Yerushalayim, the houses of prayer and the houses of study were maintained. The Jews prayed to Hashem and studied his mitzvahs every day. In other words, besides having the Beis HaMikdash, there definitely were shuls and yeshivas all over Eretz Yisrael. The men of the Great Assembly instituted a definite order of prayers, laying the foundation for our present daily prayer book. The principal prayers were the Shema and the Shemone Esrei. The Shema, Hear, O Israel, Hashem is our God, Hashem is one, consisting of three chapters taken from the Torah, is the Jews' declaration of his faith in one God. Surrounded by nations and peoples who were non-Jews and idol worshippers, the Shema was a challenge to the whole world. During times of religious persecution, almost down to our own times, many a Jew bravely faced a martyr's death with the words of the Shema on his dying lips. In addition to the proclamation of the unity of Hashem, this prayer contains the most important fundamental principles of our faith. The Shemone Esrei is a most solemn prayer. It is recited standing and therefore sometimes called the Amida, standing. It is composed of, now composed of 19, but it was originally composed of 18 brachas arranged by the men of the Great Assembly, but the 19 was added in later years, although the original name remained. The name is also used for Shabbos, even though the Shemone Esrei of Shabbos contains only 7 brachas, 7 blessings. The first three and the last three in one special one, and likewise for Jewish holidays. In the Gemara, in the Talmud, this prayer is called Tefillah, meaning prayer, which contains petitions of all human needs, both of the individual Jew and of the Jewish nation as a whole. This prayer is recited in each of the three daily services. The Anshei Knesset HaGedolah are known also as Sofrim, scribes, after Ezra Sofer. They took great pains to ensure the preservation of the Torah and its transmission intact for future generations. For the Torah was the life center of the Jewish people, and it was vital that a true record as well as interpretation of it be preserved for posterity. For this purpose, they introduced the Ketav Ashuris, the Assyrian alphabet, which we still use today for our Hebrew reading and writing. They also endeavored to diffuse the study of the Torah so that it should become the heritage of all, and not only of a few learned individuals or certain classes of people. Finally, they stressed the strict observance of the mitzvahs of the Torah, abstaining from breaking the prohibitions and fulfilling the positive commands. For this purpose, they imposed precautionary measures or bylaws known as a siyag, a fence, designed to protect the mitzvahs of the Torah from breaking down. For instance, according to the Torah, none of the 39 types of work is permitted on the Shabbos, but the men of the great assembly added to the prohibitions all manner of work which is similar to or reminiscent of any of the 39, to make sure that no mistake or carelessness lead to the desecration of the Holy Shabbos. True to their saying, as they said, be cautious in judgment, raise many pupils, and build a fence around the Torah. This is found in Pirkei Avos. The men of the great assembly established courts of justice, many schools, and set up a system of fences around the Torah, which have preserved it intact to this very day. Now we're going to talk about the Tanoim, the authors of the Mishnah. We'll start off with Shimon the Just. The work of the men of the great assembly was carried on by their direct successors and followers, the rabbis and teachers of the oral law, known as the Tanoim. The last member of the great Tanoim was Shimon the Just, Shimon HaTzadik, and he marks the beginning of the era of the Tanoim. Shimon the Just was the Kohen Gadol and ministers to his people in this exalted position for 40 years. He was a descendant of Yeshua the Kohen Gadol, who together with Zerubbabel was at the head of the first returnees from the Babylonian exile. The Kohen Gadol in those days was the recognized Jewish leader, not only in the religious field, but he was also the head of the Jewish commonwealth as a whole. The entire life of this great man was devoted to the fulfillment of his famous saying, the world's foundation, as we learn this in Pirkei Avos, rests upon three things: the Torah, divine worship, and the practice of loving kindness. Through untiring efforts, he became the greatest Torah scholar of his time and a beloved and respected teacher and sage. He traveled through the small and large communities in the Holy Land, teaching and admonishing the people. He saw to it that there should be schools for the children everywhere and provided opportunities for promising students to advance in their studies under the care of the sages in Yerushalayim. Thus, he did a great deal to perpetuate the work of the men of the great assembly. At the same time, he devoted much time and effort to the betterment of the Jewish state in general, and of Yerushalayim in particular. Many sections of the walls surrounding Jerusalem were fortified, and so were the walls around the Beis HaMikdash. An artfully built water conduit carried water straight into the inner court of the Beis HaMikdash. The services of the Kohanim and Levim were restored to their greatest dignity. He himself was the greatest Kohen Gadol that ever served in that holy edifice, and he was greatly esteemed and beloved. The sages of the Talmud declared that many miracles occurred in the Beis HaMikdash because of Rav Shimon's great piety and devotion to his people. Thus it was said that the red thread of wool that was attached to the entrance into the Beis HaMikdash on Yom Kippur turned white as a sign that Hashem had accepted the prayers and forgiven his people. Also, the perpetual light, that is, the western light of the menorah, always kept burning. There was a general blessing and prosperity in the land under Rav Shimon's administration. Once again, following the Anshei Knesset Gedolim, the men of the great assembly, the tradition of the oral law, the Torah Shebaal Peh, was carried on by the Tanoim, the teachers or the sages. The leaders of the first five generations of Tanoim were the Zugos, pairs. They were Yosef ben Yoezer of Zeratim and Yosef ben Yochanan of Yerushalayim. Number two, Yeshua ben Parachia and Nitai of Arbel. Number three, Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach. Number four, Shemaiah and Avtalion. Number five, Hillel and Shammai. Of these five pairs, the first one was the head of the Sanhedrin, or the chief justice, and the second one was the Av Beis Din, the associate chief justice. They were of such high stature, sages, gifted with such extraordinary knowledge of the Torah, they did not even bear any title of rabbi. They were the spiritual leaders of the Jewish people during one of the most difficult periods of Jewish history, and their decisions and teaching set the standards of life for the Jewish people. For this was the time when the Jewish people no longer had any kings or prophets. The Jews had not very long before begun to settle down in the homeland of Eretz Israel after their exile in Babylon. Not too much is known about the first four pairs, except for several legal decisions, halachas, and the familiar sayings recorded in the first parak of Pirkei Avos. The best known of them was Rav Shimon ben Shetach, the brother of Queen Salome Alexandra. He was particularly effective as the leader of the Jewish people by laying the foundations of a systematic elementary school system for Jewish children. This was in the beginning of the first century BCE, more than 2,000 years ago. We already spoke about the important part of he played in Jewish life, and if you'll see this under Jewish history, you'll be able to study this. So we're going to go on with Shemaya and Naftali. Shemaya and Naftali were the outstanding disciples of Shimon ben Shetach and Yehuda ben Tabai, and followed them to the officers of the head and associate head of the Sanhedrin during the turbulent period of civil war and the subsequent beginning of the Roman rule over Israel. Shemaya and Naftali both were descendants of proselytes from the family of King Sanherib. Unlike their predecessors, they took little active part in the political life of the state and concentrated mostly on the spiritual leadership. Thus, they were able to strengthen the office in all aspects of the Sanhedrin and make its influence felt in all phases of the people's life. Thinking of the fate of their predecessors, of Yehuda ben Tabai and of Yeshua ben Parachia, who had to flee to Alexandria because they had taken part in the political life, they made the well-known statements, "Love work, hate the holding of public office, and do not be associated with the ruling authorities." This again is found in Pirkei Avos. Avtalion said, "Scholars, be careful with your words. You may incur the penalty of exile and be banished to a place of evil waters, and the disciples who follow you into exile are likely to drink of them and die, with the result that the heavenly name would be profaned." Steering clear of the political struggles, Shemaya and Avtalion concentrated on producing numerous disciples who were well versed in the Torah and law and interpreted according to tradition, and who went on to teach it to the greater masses of the Jewish people. For this reason, these two noble sages were highly respected and beloved by the entire nation, even more than the Kohen Gadol himself. The Gemara in Yumra tells us the following characteristic incident. It happened in the conclusion of the Yom Kippur services, when the masses accompanied the Kohen Gadol to his house after nightfall. Suddenly the masses perceived Shemaya and Naftali. At once they left the Kohen Gadol and flocked to the two sages to show them their respect. Unfortunately, the Kohen Gadol considered this as an affront to his own person, and despite the congratulations of the Chachomim, he told them, "May the strangers, meaning the descendants of Heaton, go in peace." Thereupon Shemaya and Naftali replied, "May the strangers walk in peace and do the work of the children of Aaron, which has been neglected by the son of Aaron, who does not follow in his great ancestors' ways." A more serious clash occurred later with Herod himself, then governor of the northern province. Under the pretense of freeing the land from robbers, Herod had put to death several patriotic Jews, among them the military leader Hizkiyahu. Called before the Sanhedrin for this evil deed of killing Jews without trial and conviction by the Sanhedrin, Herod appeared fully armed and surrounded by his guards. The Supreme Court was intimidated, and no one dared to rise and take up the case against Herod. Even King Hyrcanus did not dare speak up against Herod, the favorite of the mighty Romans. Then it was Shemaya who got up, unafraid of the consequences, to prosecute Herod. He reprimanded the king and his colleagues for their cowardice and fear. encouraged by Shemaiah, the judge proceeded to take up the case and to pronounce the death penalty against Herod, but the king prevented it by postponing the final judgment and by permitting Herod to escape during the night. Even Herod himself was impressed by the fearlessness and justice of the two great sages. They were the only ones whom he permitted to live and to remain in office when he killed all the members of the Sanhedrin after his accession to the throne. Another reason for respecting the two may have been the fact that when Herod besieged Jerusalem, Shemaiah and Naphtali counseled for surrender to him and to his reign to prevent bloodshed. Among the better known regulations introduced by Shemaiah and Naphtali was the charge of a tarfik, a quarter of a dinar, to be paid to the doorman for admittance to the Beis Medrash. This measure was designed to help finance education of thousands of students. Most famous among their students were Hillel and Shammai, their successors to the highest offices. Let's talk about Hillel and Shammai. Hillel was known as the Bavli, the Babylonian, because he was born in Babylonia in a family of immigrants. He's also known as Hillel HaZaken, the elder Hillel, in distinction from Hillel number 2, his descendant, was particularly known for his arrangement of the Jewish calendar and the Jewish holidays on a permanent basis. Hillel stemmed from one of the noblest Jewish families. On his mother's side, he traced his ancestry back to David HaMelech, King David, and on his father's side to the tribe of Benjamin. He was born approximately the year 80 BCE in Babylonia. He first came to the Holy Land when he was 40 years old, in order to study at the Beis Medrash of Shemaiah and Naphtali, which we just mentioned before. Despite his noble descent, Hillel was living in very poor circumstances. He earned his living as a woodchopper, earning one coin a day, called a tarfik, of which he used half to pay for his admission to the Beis Medrash to study, house study, and the other to support himself and his family. One day Hillel had not earned enough to pay the admission fee. In order not to miss even a single day's learning, he climbed to the roof and lay down next to a skylight where he listened to Shemaiah and Naphtali's lecture. So engrossed was he that he paid no attention to the snow that had meanwhile begun to fall, for it was in the middle of winter. Noticing the unusual darkness, Shemaiah and Naphtali looked up to the ceiling and noticed a human figure pressed to the skylight. Hillel was brought down, fed, and warmed up. A man like he, said the sages, deserves that the holy Shabbos be violated in his behalf. After he had absorbed as much Torah as possible, Hillel returned to Babylonia, where he continued to study and spread the teachings of his teachers Shemaiah and Naphtali, while his brother Shachne provided the means of his livelihood. Hillel introduced 7 of the famous 13 principles of interpreting the written law, such as Kal Vachomer, the inference from a minor premise to a major one, or Gezer Shavah, the inference from the similarity of words or phrases to psukim of the Torah, that what is expressed in one pasuk applies also to the other. After 40 years in Babylonia, Hillel returned to the Holy Land, Eretz Israel, a second time to stay there for the rest of his life. At first he had gone there to learn and to find out some information that he was lacking. Yet when he came to Sanhedrin, then headed by the weak B'nai B'tzirira, it was he who was able to answer a question concerning the law of slaughtering the Paschal lamb on the Erev Pesach coinciding with Shabbos. Though they rejected Hill's method of interpretation, they accepted his answer when he declared that he had received a tradition from Shemaiah and Naphtali. This established him as the undisputed head of the scholars of his time, and he became head of the Sanhedrin, which office he held for many years. To describe his importance, our sages said that when the Torah was forgotten the first time, Ezra came and brought it back. When it was again forgotten, Hillel came from Babylonia and returned the knowledge and study of Torah in the Holy Land of Israel back to its old splendor. This indeed was Hillel's greatest achievement. He did not engage in politics, but concentrated mainly on teaching Torah to wider masses of Jewish youth to disseminate the principles of the proper interpretation of the written law, Torah Shebiksav, and to produce disciples capable of becoming the leaders of the future generations. He is said to have had 80 such outstanding disciples, all of them worthy of prophetic vision. The greatest of them all was Rav Yonah ben Aziel, and the youngest was Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, who subsequently saved the Sanhedrin and the future of our people after the capture of Yerushalayim by the Romans. Some of the more familiar practical regulations which Hillel introduced in Jewish life during the time that he headed the Sanhedrin were the Puzbul, a legal document by which a debt that would have been lost because of the law of the seventh year Shemitah was turned over to the court for collection. Because of the law of remission of debts by the sabbatical year Shemitah, people had refrained from lending money to each other. The Puzbul was thus an important economic measure for the country. Another decree which he introduced was that a man who had sold his house did not require the presence of the buyer to redeem his house. It was enough to make a statement before the court and to leave the money for the redemption of the house there. Similarly, all of Hillel's work is characterized by kindness, consideration, and compassion with other people's needs, but above all with the preservation of the Torah and the purity of the faith. The Talmud tells numerous stories about Hillel's patience, love of peace, and love of other human beings. Famous is the one in which two people made a bet, whereby one of them had to make Hillel angry. He came to Hillel's house on a busy Friday afternoon with all kinds of foolish questions, such as, why are the heads of the Babylonians round? Why did the Talmudians have dull eyes? Why do the Africans have broad feet? Yet each time Hillel interrupted his preparation for the Shabbos and gave the man a sensible answer. Finally, the man exclaimed, how many more questions do I have to ask until your patience will come to an end? Don't be afraid, replied Hillel patiently. Keep on asking, and I shall be glad to answer as best as I can. Now the patience of the questioner had come to an end, and he exclaimed, aren't you Hillel, whom they call the Prince of Israel? Would that there should not be more of your kind in Israel. Disregarding the insult, Hillel asked, why? Because your patience has cost me 400 zuzim in a wager. Well, replied Hillel, it's better that you should lose a bet of 400 zuzim, and even twice that amount, than that Hillel should lose his patience. Another incident tells of a non-Jew who wanted to learn the whole Torah during the time that he could stand at one foot. When he approached Shammai, Hillel's great associate, he chased him away. Hillel, however, told him, do not do unto others what you do not want others to do unto you. Everything else of the Torah is only merely commentary to this basic law. Now go and study the rest. This and similar stories point to Hillel's love for humanity and his efforts to spread the highest virtues of the Jewish faith. Thus we find his favorite motto in Pirkei Avos that says, be of the disciples of Aaron, loving peace and pursuing peace. Be one who loves his fellow men and draws them near to the Torah. Or we have another one that says, do not judge your fellow man until you have been in his position. Another time Hillel stated an impoverished man has to be supported in such a fashion that he will be able to continue to live in the same manner to which he had been accustomed. Hillel went so far as to say that someone who was used to having a horse or a servant should be given a horse or a servant. Another important characteristic of Hillel was his faith in Hashem. He never doubted that Hashem would each day send him what he needed. Once when he heard noise and tumult as he approached his house, he said full of faith, I'm sure this commotion does not come from my house. Hundreds of similar stories attest to Hillel's faith, his hospitality and love for others, which explain his great popularity with the people and the lasting respect which he earned for all the time. Hillel's associate as Av Beis Din was Shammai, a man of equal stature as a scholar, teacher, and leader in Israel. He too was a disciple of Shammai and Avtalion, and he continued their work. Though not characterized by Hillel's endless patience, Shammai devoted all of his life to preserve the truth of the Torah and to base all conduct on its laws. He also was very much concerned with his neighbor and with fairness and justice, as we read in Pirkei Avos, "Make your study of the Torah a regular routine. Say little but do much, and receive everyone graciously." From this and other teachings, we can see that Shammai was not the hard, quick-tempered man he may appear to be, and always trying to find the strictest side of the halacha. Above all, Hillel and Shammai were very close and good personal friends. The sages say that the differences of opinion between Hillel and Shammai were indeed the Shem Shammayim, not for personal or argument's sake, but for the purpose of establishing the exact halacha, the law, as prescribed in the Divine Torah. Furthermore, Hillel and Shammai did not insist they were always right, and conceded to each other when they saw the justification of the other's view. Actually, Hillel and Shammai themselves had only different opinions in three major questions of the halacha. It was their disciples and schools, the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai, that developed differences of opinion on many points of law. Let's talk about the schools of Hillel and Shammai. Hillel and Shammai were called the Avos HaOlam, the patriarchs of the world. Indeed, it was they and their way of learning and teaching that established the major schools of Torah study and Torah interpretation. For more than a century, the schools of Hillel and Shammai, Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, continued to interpret the traditions handed down to them by these two sages. However, whereas the founders, Hillel and Shammai themselves, disagreed only three major issues, there are over 300 issues in the Talmud in which the two schools differed. Generally, the interpretation of Beis Hillel was inclined to be less stringent, and that of Beis Shammai took the stricter view. In the majority of cases in which the two schools differed, the sages ruled in favor of Beis Hillel, except in 18 issues of the law in which the final decision followed the interpretation of Beis Shammai. Once the law was decided according to one or the other, all differences of opinion ended and tradition was established. Let's talk about Akavya ben Mahalel, one of the great contemporaries of Hillel Shammai and also disciple of Shammai and Naphtali. Was Akavya ben Mahalel, a member of the first generation of Tanoim. He was a scholar of unbending convictions. He persisted in his view even when it differed from that of the majority of the scholars of his days. When he was offered the office of Av Beis Din, if he were to withdraw his opinion in the four decisions in which he differed from the opinion of the majority of the sages, he refused steadfastly. "I'd rather be judged a fool for refusing such high honor than be judged wrong before the court of heavenly judgment," he said. However, before his death, he told his son to follow the opinion of the majority rather than his own, and in the four decisions in which he had differed. When his son questioned him why he himself had refused to yield his opinion, he replied, "I received my decision from several sages, and they too have followed the view they have received from several sages. I stuck to my tradition and they to theirs. You, however, have heard it only from me, from one person. It's therefore right that you should follow the majority opinion." The following story also gives elegant evidence of Akavya's exceptional character. Once his son asked him for a letter of recommendation, Akavya refused to give his son a letter of recommendation and praise, saying, "Your actions and conduct will speak for you and prove your value." Although he was such an outstanding figure among the great scholars of his time, we find his name only three times more in connection with Halacha and the Mishnah. In addition to the four in which he had differed from the majority of the sages, however, some of the deepest and most moving wise words have been preserved of Akavya ben Mahalel in Pirkei Avos, which says, "Reflect on three things, and you will not come into the grip of sin. Know from where you come from, where you are going to go, and before whom you are destined to give a strict account. Where you came from a malodorous drop, and where you are going, to a place that dusts worms and moths, and before whom you are destined to give a strict account before the Supreme King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be He. Let's talk about Rabbi Gamliel number one. Rabbi Gamliel number one, also known as the Hazokain, the Elder, in distinction from his grandson Gamliel II, was a grandson of Hillel number one. And like his illustrious ancestor, one of the greatest scholars and spiritual leaders of the Jewish people, during one of its saddest periods in history. Many have compared him to a brightly sparkling star on the horizon of Israel. He lived at the time of the Roman emperors Caligula and his successor Claudius, and he died 18 years before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Under Caligula, the Roman yoke was heavy in the Jewish land and stifled the spiritual development, but when Claudius, a friend of the Jewish prince Agrippa number one, eased the restrictions on the Jewish people, the spiritual life too, guided by Rabbi Gamliel, revived and went through a period of great growth. Rabbi Gamliel number one was then the Nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin, and under him his office gained its greatest respect both internally among the Jewish people and outside of the Holy Land. The Talmudic literature owes much to Rabbi Gamliel's work and to his decisions. Numerous Jewish laws bear his name. Yet in the Mishnah itself, only four decisions are associated with his name. Like his grandfather Hillel, he was very much concerned with the welfare of the people, and many of his important decisions were ordinances established Mipnei Tikkun Ha'olam, in the public interest, to preserve the proper social order and to protect the welfare of the needy and the suffering. Several of these ordinances of Rabbi Gamliel deal with laws of marriage and divorce. For instance, Jewish law permitted a husband who lived far from his wife to send her a bill of divorce, a get, through a messenger instead of having to hand it to her personally. Yet, while it was on the way, the husband was permitted to cancel the get before an authorized court elsewhere. This led to many difficulties and unpleasantness for the woman, who could never be sure that her husband had not meanwhile canceled her divorce before it reached her. Therefore, Rabbi Gamliel I decreed that this practice of cancellation at a different court was not permissible. Furthermore, he ordained that a get should bear all the names and aliases of the husband and the wife by which they were known anywhere, and not only their original names and places of residence. A third ordinance of Rabbi Gamliel, number one, made it legal for one witness, instead of the usually required two, to testify to the death of the husband, and thus prevented his wife to remarry. Rabbi Gamliel's motto is quoted in Pirkei Avos that says, "Provide yourself with a teacher and avoid doubt, and do not make a habit of using estimates and guesswork in giving Maaser, the tithe." The importance of Rabbi Gamliel's influence as the spiritual head of the Jewish people and the esteem in which he was held are evident from various statements of the sages. One of them reads, "With the death of Rabbi Gamliel passed away the glory of Torah and the purity and the power of absence." They tell that Rabbi Gamliel was exceptionally holy in his conduct. Even ordinary food, chulin, he ate with the same holiness as if it were holy food, and he exhorted his disciples to the same high level of purity and holiness. The command of kachem tiyu, shall be holy, refers not only to the kohanim levim, he said, but it concerns also the plain Jewish people, for it is written, "Speak to an entire Jewish community and say to them, you shall be holy." Rabbi Gamliel was spared from seeing the decline of the Jewish people and their land after the death of King Agrippa and the catastrophe of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. But it was in his days that the Sanhedrin had to leave its original seat in the Lishka HaGozis in the Beis HaMikdash and had to meet outside on the Temple Mountain. Let's talk about Rabbi Hanina, the assistant Kohen Gadol, or alternatively Hananya. The two first names are often interchanged in Talmudic literature. Was a Tana who lived in the days of the second Beis HaMikdash to witness its destruction. As his title indicates, he was deputy to the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, serving as an understudy should the Kohen Gadol become richly unfit to perform his duties. Rabbi Hanina stood ready to serve in his stead. This is brought down the Gemara Yuma. He made authoritative statements from first-hand knowledge on how things had been done or not done at the Beis Hamikdash. In the Medrash he says, "Great is peace, for it ranks equal with the works of creation, and the last part of the Kohen's blessing, may he grant you peace," found the Chumash Bamidbar, "means for him in your name." This is quoted by the Midrash Sifri in Chumash Bamidbar. Taken with his teaching in Pirkei Avos that one should pray for the welfare of the government and power, it would indicate that he regarded the Roman conquest of Israel as ordained by heaven, and peace and order under its rule were to be preferred and sought rather than the horrid alternative of turbulence and bloodshed through rebellion. Nevertheless, according to one account, he met a martyr's death at the hands of the Romans. This is brought down in the Gemara Megillus Tainus. Let's talk about Reb Hananya ben Tarajan, a second century Tanner of the third century generation, maintained a yeshiva at Siknin, which grew in importance and authority. Gemara Rosh Hashanah and Gemara Sanhedrin brings this down. He scrupulously collected and distributed the charity there, and once when his own money that he planned to use for Purim became mixed with charity funds, he gave it all away to the poor. No one said Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov at a later time should contribute to a charity unless its administrators, like Rav Hananya ben Tarajan. This is the Gemara Bava Basra, and the Gemara Avodah Zarah says so. In Pirkei Avos, he dwells on the great value of Torah study, and he lived up to his teaching. He lived during the Hadrianic persecutions after the defeat of Bar Kokhba in 135 CE, when Rome forbade Torah study on pain or death. Rav Hananya continued to teach and lecture in public. He and his wife were sentenced to death and his daughters to slavery. Wrapped in a Torah scroll, he was set afire. It was then that he made his immoral remark as he mastered his great pain. "I see the parchment of the Torah scroll burning, but the letters soar upwards." So moved by his courage and intense piety was the Roman attendant that he asked him, "If I hasten your death to spare you extra pain, will you see that I live in the hereafter?" Rabbi Hananya agreed. The attendant removed wet woolen sponges that had been placed on the sage's body to prolong his deathful suffering, and he died at once, and then and there the attendant jumped into the flames, as the Gemara Avodah Zarah tells us. A second daughter, Bruyer, was the learned and talented wife of a mayor who incidentally rescued the first daughter from slavery. The Talmud relates many anecdotes about her sterling character and her knowledge of Torah. Let's talk about Rav Shimon bar Yochai, one of the most important Tannaim in the post-Hadrianic period, the middle of the 2nd century. For 13 years he studied with Rabbi Akiva to become one of his most illustrious students. He and Rabbi Meir were the only disciples among thousands whom Rabbi Akiva personally ordained. Gemara Sanhedrin brings this down. While Rabbi Akiva was waiting death for having taught Torah in defiance of Rome's decrees, Rav Shimon dared to visit him in prison to question him about Torah laws, as Gemara Pesachim tells us. After his great master's death as a martyr, Rav Shimon and four others were ordained by Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba, as the Gemara Sanhedrin tells us. Strongly antagonistic to Roman rule and persecution, Rav Shimon was eventually forced to hide with his son in a cave near Gedorah for some 13 years, where they subsisted only on carobs and water that miraculously they found nearby. Their bodies became covered with sores, and when they went free at last, as a sign that they no longer had anything to fear, they went to the warm mineral springs of Tiberias to heal themselves. And this has brought down the Gemara Shabbos and the Gemara Shavias. Rabbi Shimon then founded a yeshiva at Miron, as the Medrash Tanchuma parts of the Kuri brings down. And in later years he went with Rabbi Elazar ben Yossi to Rome to persuade the emperor to reveal imperial decrees that forbade three main Jewish religious observances. His mission was successful, as the Gemara in Me'ilah brings down. A man of great piety and learning, he ever denounced haughtiness, deceit, and interest, collecting interest, and he passionately advocated domestic harmony and adherence to all the mitzvahs of the Torah. The Talmud credits him with many miracles and mystic powers. In the world of mysticism, he is believed to have spent his years in the cave in a Sortic study. On the traditional anniversary of his death, the minor holiday called Lag BaOmer, vast numbers visit his tomb in Miron to celebrate and pray. As in fact, I was once there on Lag BaOmer. It was over 100,000 people crowded there. It's unbelievable. Let's talk about Rabbi Hanina ben Chachinai, a Tana of the younger third generation of the first half of the second century CE, was mainly a Talmud of Rabbi Akiva, with whom he studied 12 or 13 years in Bnei Brak, as the Gemara Kesuvos brings down, in company with Rabbi Shim bar Yochai. The Talmud and Medrash relate that when he finally returned to his native town after this long period of uninterrupted study, he found the streets and pathways so altered that he could not recognize the way to his home. He went and sat by the river, where he heard a girl being called daughter of Hachina. He thought, "She must surely be my daughter," and he followed her home. Entering without warning, he gave his wife such a shock of surprise that she died. Said he, "Is this the reward of the poor woman for having struggled so many?" Again, said he, "Is this the reward of the poor woman for having struggled so many years alone so that he could study Torah?" He prayed for her and she revived. Though not ordained, he was permitted to argue cases before the ordained Chachamim, sages in Yavne, a privilege granted to very few, as the Gemara Sanhedrin tells us. He was reputed to be one of the four in Yavne who knew 70 languages, as the Gemara Mishkolim tells us. At the age of 95, he met a tragic death at the hands of the Romans as one of the 10 martyrs. Let's talk about Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakonim. Was also called Rabbi Nechunya HaGadol, the Great, flourished late in the first century CE, a pupil or a contemporary of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, as Gemara Basra tells us, and the main Rebbe, Rabbi Shmuel. A man of wealth with many servants, he was distinguished for his humility and forgiving nature, qualities shown in two prayers of his that he was wont to recite, as the Mishnah in Brochus tells us. Blessed with years, he attributed his long life to the fact that he would never glory in or derive esteem from the shame of another human being. He would never retain hate or indelibly curse others, and he gave of his money freely, as the Gemara Megillah tells us. He was said to have interpreted the entire written Torah by the rule of Kal Uprat, general and particular, with his pupil Rabbi Shmuel made the 8 of his 13 rules for interpreting the Torah. The mystic work Sefer HaBehir and the short acrostic prayer Ana B'chol are ascribed to him. It's a short prayer based on the holy name of the 42 letters mentioned of Hashem's name, Gemara Kiddush. Let's talk about Rabbi Chalafta ben Dosa of Kfar Hananya, was a Tana of the 5th generation who lived in the latter half of the 2nd century CE. Very little is known about him. In Pirkei Avos he's called Ben Dosa, the son of Dosa, but in the commentary of Machzor Vitri, ascribed to a Talmud of Rashi, these words do not appear, so that even his father's name is not altogether certain. He was apparently a pupil of Rabbi Meir, where the Talmud records an important law about the validity of conditions affecting obligations which he gave in Rabbi Meir's name, as Gemara Bava Mitzvah tells us, and there he is called Abba Chalafta,
Abba means literally father, and the title respect similar to Rebbe. Otherwise, he is mentioned only once more in Talmudic literature. In the Tosefta, he reports two different views on the point of halachim by the son and daughter of Hananya ben Tradjo. This is a Tosefta in the Sefta Kalim. And we also mentioned earlier that under Rabbi Hananya ben Tradjo, that his daughter Bruya was learned and became the wife of Rabbi Meir. Let's talk about Rabbi Elazar ben Yehuda of Be'er Tosa. Was a Tana of the third generation in the first half of the second century CE. He was a disciple of Rabbi Shua ben Hananya, in whose name he transmits four halachas. It's a Mishnah in Masechet Tevul Yom, and also found in Pesachim and in Choros. And a contemporary of Rabbi Kiva, with whom he differed. Apparently he studied and flourished in Yavne. As we counted in Pirkei Avos, he was known to be extremely charitable, often giving so wholeheartedly and extravagantly as to leave himself penniless. For this reason, the charity collectors would try to avoid him, as the Gemara in Tainus tells us. One biographer of the sages surmises that of Shimon ben Elazar, a noted town of the 2nd and 3rd centuries, who was an important pupil of a mayor, was this sage's son. Let's talk about Rav Yaakov ben Korsha or Korshai, both of which most likely means of Korsha, was a mid-century Tana of the 4th generation, a contemporary of Rabbi Gamliel number 2, whom he once befriended against opposing colleagues, as the Gemara in Horus tells us. On his mother's side, he was a grandson of Elisha ben Abuya Acher. Like his maternal grandfather, this sage once noticed that a dutiful son, obeying his father, climbed the tree to acquire some young birds' fledglings. In accordance with the Torah's command, he first sent the mother bird away. Thus he fulfilled the two mitzvahs which the Torah explicitly promises long life: respect for parents and sending off the mother bird, as we find in Chumash Devarim. And yet, as the son began to climb down, he fell to his death. Rabbi Yaakov's faith was undisturbed. In this world, said he, there's no reward for good deeds. The promised rewards are given in the world, which is all good and immeasurably long. Many decades later, a Babylonian Amora commented, had Acher interpreted those promises of the Torah as his daughter's son did, he would not have become a sinner, as the Gemara in Kedushin, Chulin, etc. In a later chapter in Pirkei Avos, Rabbi Yaakov has more to say about the supreme importance of the hereafter, the world to come. This is found in Pirkei Avos, Perek Dalit, at Ushad, where Rav Yaakov was a member of the Sanhedrin, as we find in the Gemara Horius. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel chose him as a tutor for his son, the future of Yehuda Hanasi, as the Gemara Shabbos and Gemara Pesachim tells us. From what we know of Rav Yehuda Hanasi, this would be a clear indication of Yaakov's mastery of oral Torah, for he must have had laid the groundwork on which Rabbi Yehuda later relied in putting together the Mishnayos. Another striking maxim of this sage is, he said, whoever has no wife lives without goodness, without help, without joy, blessing, or atonement. It's brought down by Medrash Rabbah on Chumash Bereishis. Let's go to Rav Dostai ben Yanai. The name is from the Greek Dositius. He was a Tana of the 5th generation in the 2nd, 3rd century CE. He is chiefly known for the rulings of Rabbi Meir, whose disciple he was, Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Elazar, that he transmitted. He was an older contemporary of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Possessed of a fine sense of humor, he would often meet the questions of his pupils with answers that were permeated with wit. As the Gemara Nida Pesachim tell us, this indicates that he maintained yeshiva as well. Once he explained how he had acted with sagacity to save his life from hostile people of great strength and authority, had they killed Dostai, he concluded with a twinkle, who would have given my father Yanai another son like me? More Gittin brings this down, and also the Gemara Kedushin. Let's talk about Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa. He was a Talmud of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, as the Gemara Berachos tells us, and he was a Tan of the first century in the first and second generations, yet before the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash in 70 CE, when he must have been quite young, he already had reputation as a miracle worker. Throughout his life, many wondrous miracles came about through his prayer and piety, especially were his prayers for the sick. In one instance, they brought about the recovery of his teacher's son. In another instance, the son of Rabbi Gamliel number 2, the Mishnah Berachos. The famous story of the three-legged golden table of the world to come, and numerous other tales of wonder are told of him throughout the Talmud and the Medrash. Rav Hanina was exceedingly poor all of his life. It was said that every day a divine voice proclaimed from Mount Horeb, the whole world is fed by the merit of Hanina my son, but as for Hanina my son, he finds a measure of carobs enough from one Shabbos Eve to the next. This is brought down the Gemara Berachos, Gemara Tainus, Gemara Chulin, etc. This earthly world, says the Talmud, was created for Achab, the son of Omri. And the world to come was made for Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa, Gemara Berachos, etc. When he was gone to his eternal reward, the Chachamim declared that with him piety vanished and effective men of supernatural deed were no more. This is the Mishnah in Masechta Sota. Let's talk about Rabbi Dosa ben Hyrcanus, or Archinas, as it's written in the Yishalmi Talmud, was one of the early Tanoim of the first and second generations. In the 1st and 2nd century CE, a contemporary of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he apparently studied in his youth in the Sheba of Hillel, as the Gemara Yevamos tells us. Yet, in the days of the Beis Hamikdash, he was one of the noteworthy sages, often giving the deciding opinion in disputes on Jewish halacha, the Mishnah in the Masechta Ksuvos. A man of wealth, he lived on after the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash from an unusual old age to the days when Gamliel number 2 became Nasi in Yavne. Though he was too old to come to the Beis Hamikdash in Yavne, he continued to take an active interest in the learned discussions. His opinions and rulings were held in great esteem, and the Chachamim should come to his house to learn from him. According to one source, he had grown blind, but his memory remained crystal clear, as found in the Masechta Yevamos. Although a man of strong views, he believed it necessary in cases of dispute to bow to the central authority of the Nasi and his court, as found in the Gemara Rosh Hashanah. Let's talk about Rabbi Eliezer of Modin, whose name is frequently given as Eliezer, was a town of the second and third generations in the first and second century CE, a disciple of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, found the Gemara Baba Basra. He was a master of Agadah, homiletic interpretations, stories and metaphors of faith and belief, moral teaching, lessons of comfort, parables and allegories, and so on. Many discussions on Torah interpretation between him and his distinguished colleagues, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya and Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, are recorded. In one instance, we find him studying and clarifying the prophecies of Yirmiyahu with Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. This is a pasuk that the Rav Kahana has brought down. The Nasi Rabbi Gamliel number 2 held his Torah interpretation in high regard and once remarked, the views of the Modai, the sage of Modin, are yet indispensable to us, as the Gemara Shabbos, Megillah, Baba Basra, Chulin, etc. bring down. A man of great trust in divine providence, Rabbi Eliezer would say, the one who creates the day creates its sustenance. He who has food for the day and worries over what he may find to eat the next day is of those who have little faith. Gemara brought down in the Gemara Sota. He was an uncle of Bar Kokhba, who in 132 CE led a revolt against the Roman oppression. Bar Kokhba's last stronghold was the fortress of Beitar, where the Romans besieged him. In the fortress, Rabbi Elazar fasted and prayed every day in ashes and sackcloth that Beitar should not fall. The sages attest that his piety kept the fortress impregnable until a treacherous Kushite made Bar Kokhba suspect his uncle of treason. In a fit of rage, Bar Kokhba killed the sage, and soon Beitar fell. More in Tainus, it brings this down. Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha was a Tan of the younger group of the second generation. In the 1st-2nd century CE, he came of a wealthy family of Kahanim, as is a Tosefta in the Sechta Chala that brings us down, and also in Gemara Baba Kama. And his father may have yet served in the Beis Hamikdash. His grandfather was probably the Kohen Gadol of the same name. Taken into captivity by the Romans as a boy, he was ransomed by Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya for a high price. Rabbi Yeshua, noting his great knowledge of the Torah, saw in him a future teacher of his people. So Sefton in the Sechta Horis and the Gemara Gittin brings us down as well. Along with other teachers, Rabbi Yeshua helped the boy develop into a prominent scholar. Of a gentle and friendly nature, Rabbi Shmuel urged goodwill and peace. And Chumash Devarim, he commented that hate leads on to slander. The Medrash Sifrin, Chumash Devarim, with his charity and his rulings, he sought to help impoverished Jewish girls to marry and to aid women whose husbands were drawn into war. In time, he became one of the outstanding members of the Sanhedrin Yavne, and when it had to move to Usha, he went with it, as Gemara Bava Basra tells us. His 13 principles or rules for interpreting the written Torah have become part of Shachris, our morning prayers, where it says of Shmuel Mechon. Again, it says of Shmuel Omer recited the end of the introductory section of the morning prayers. It was also he who laid the foundation for the Mechilta, the halachic medrash on Chumash Shemos, and the Sifri, the medrash on Chumash Bamidbar. A great part of these works derives from his school, and they illustrate his interpretive approach. According to some sources, he met the tragic death of a martyr during the Hadrianic persecutions. Let's talk about Rabbi Kiva, the famous Rabbi Kiva ben Yosef, who lived about 40-135 CE, was of a poor and humble parentage and ignorant until the age of 40, as the Gemara in Brachos tells us, Gemara Pesachim tells us, and Avester Mnosson tells us, aided by his loyal wife Rachel, daughter of the wealthy Kalbas Sabul, he studied long and intensely with the great scholars of Yavne, while both suffered hardship. To support themselves, he sold firewood, and once she cut off and sold her long hair. For many years they were separated, so that he could devote himself entirely to his Torah study in Yavne, until in time he became a distinguished master of Jewish law. Regarded the eventuality as the greatest scholar of his time, he had thousands of students at his yeshiva in Bnei Brak, as Gemara Yevamos, Nedarim, Ketuvos tell us, among them the outstanding teachers of the coming generation. His recorded teachings reflect his modesty and humility, and his benevolence and kindness were proverbial, as Tosefta Megillah brings down, Gemara Nedarim, etc. But above all, he was gifted with remarkable intellectual powers. Concerning his greatness as an interpreter of the written Torah, the Talmud relates that on Sinai, Moshe saw Hashem making little crowns as decorations on the letters of the Torah. When he asked the reason for them, he was told that one day a sage named Rabbi Kiva ben Yosef would derive legal interpretations and rulings from every crown and grace line on these letters. This is brought down in the Gemara Menachos. A pioneer in Torah interpretation, he also gathered and arranged the entire oral Torah according to subjects, establishing the basis of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's later putting together of the Mishnah, as the Gemara Sanhedrin tells us. when Rome issued decrees against the Jewish faith, Rabbi Akiva was among those who went to the imperial capital to seek their appeal. Or brought down the sukkah. But ultimately, Rome categorically forbade the study of Torah. Rabbi Akiva calmly ignored the decree, and in 135 CE, shortly after the defeat of Bar Kokhba, whom he had supported, hoping that he was the Mashiach, he met a martyr's death with the words of the Shema as his last utterance. This is brought down in Gemara Brachos. No Tanna had a deeper influence on Jewish religious history. Let's talk about Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. He was a second generation Tanna, 1st, 2nd century CE of distinguished birth, for his ancestry was traced back 10 generations to Ezra the Sofer, as the Gemara in Brachos and Gemara Yevamos tells us. Immensely wealthy, he was also very learned, a disciple of Elazar ben Hyrcanus, as Gemara Sanhedrin brings down. While still very young, he was elevated temporarily to the position of a Nasi patriarch. Tradition relates that his beard turned white overnight to give him the appearance of advanced age, so that his older colleagues could accept him without envy or painful misgivings. When his predecessor, Rabbi Gamliel number 2, was returned to this position of eminence, he remained the deputy Nasi or Av Beis Din, lecturing on one Shabbos of each month. This is brought down in the Gemara Baruchos and Tainus. His fortune derived from wine, oil, and cattle. The Septa in Avodah Zarah and the Gemara in Bava Basri, Shabbos and Beyer. His fortune was so large that later Chachamim, the sages, taught that his appearance in the dream presaged the coming of vast wealth. Gemara in Baruchas. He used this fortune for the wealth of the people during the Roman persecutions before Bar Kokhba's ill-fated uprising. Rabbi Elazar preferred to interpret the Torah simply, saying the Torah expressed itself in human language, as the Gemara Kedushin tells us, and in his humanness he declared the Sanhedrin court that passes a death sentence once in 70 years is called a murderous one. This is a Mishnah Masechet Makos. Once he visited the age of Dose ben Hyrcanus, whereupon the hoary sage quoted about him, "I have been young and I have grown old, and I have not seen the righteous abandoned or his children begging bread." This is found in the Sefer Tehillim and the Gemara Yevamos. For Rabbi Dose had known his father, and Rabbi Yeshua said of him, "The generation in which Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah flourishes cannot be called an orphan generation," as the Gemara Chagiga brings down. When he was taken on high, it was said that the crowning glories of wisdom were removed. It's a Tosefta, it's a Tosfos in Gemara's Sota. Let's talk about Rav Elazar Chisma, or Ben Chisma, according to other readings, was a Tanna of the 2nd century CE of the 2nd and 3rd generations, a disciple of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Gamliel number 2, but mainly Rabbi Yeshua Ben Hananya. He was outstanding not only in his vast rabbinic learning, but also in sciences. When Rabbi Yeshua presented him and Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri to Rabbi Gamliel, he stated that they could calculate the number of drops of water in the ocean. As the Gemara Horius brings down, despite their learning, the two were extremely poor without adequate food or clothing, as Rabbi Yeshua was informed Rabbi Gamliel the Nasi. At that, the Nasi appointed them to well-paid positions, making them supervisors in his yeshiva. At first, the two would not attend the academy. Rabbi Gamliel the Nasi sent for them. "Do you think I'm giving you sovereignty?" he asked. "I'm giving you bondage." When they entered at last, the two sat among the students, assuming no authority or responsibility, until Rabbi Gamliel soon compelled them. "Until now," said he, "you were your own masters. From now on, you are the bondage servants of the community." Medrash Sifri in Chumash Devarim. The word Chisma, some read Chasma, is most likely meant as the name of a place called Chisma. Ben would therefore mean a native of, but it may also possibly mean vigor, indicating Rabbi Elazar's strength in expounding the Torah, or it may derive from Chasima, restriction alluding to an important ruling of his in the Mishnah, a Mishnah that's found in the Masechta Bava Metzia. With this, we have concluded our shiur today on biographies of Tanoim.